From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Mrs. Todd's Shortcut by Stephen King. There goes the Todd woman, I said. Homer Buckland watched a little jaguar go by and nodded. The woman raised her hand to Homer. Homer nodded his big, shaggy head to her, but didn't raise his own hand in return. The Todd family had a big summer home on Castle Lake, and Homer had been their caretaker since time out of mind. I had an idea that he disliked Worth Todd's second wife every bit as much as he'd liked Felia Todd, the first one. This was just about 2 years ago, and we were sitting on a bench in front of Bell's Market, me with an orange soda pop, Homer with a glass of mineral water. It was October, which is a peaceful time in Castle Rock. Lots of the lake places still get used on the weekends, but the aggressive, boozy summer socializing is over by then, and the hunters with their big guns and their expensive non-resident permits pinned to their orange caps haven't started to come into town yet. Crops have been mostly laid by. Nights are cool, good for sleeping, and old joints like mine haven't yet started to complain. In October, the sky over the lake is passing fair, with those big white clouds that move so slow. I like how they seem so flat on the bottoms and how they're a little gray there, like with a shadow of sundown foretold. And I can watch the sun sparkle on the water and not be bored for some space of minutes. It's in October, sitting on the bench in front of Bell's and watching the lake from afar off, that I still wish I was a smoking man. She don't drive as fast as Felia, Homer said. A swan, I used to think. What an old-fashioned name she had for a woman that could put a car through its paces like she could. Summer people like the Todds are nowhere near as interesting to the year-round residents of small main towns as they themselves believe. Year-round folk prefer their own love stories and hate stories and scandals and rumors of scandal. What, that textile fellow from Amesbury shot himself? Estonia Corbridge found that after a week or so, she couldn't even get invited to lunch on her story of how she found him, with a pistol still in one stiffening hand. But folks are still not done talking about Joe Camber, who got killed by his own dog. Well, it don't matter. It's just that there are different race courses we run on. Summer people are trotters. Us others that put on ties to do our week's work are just pacers. Even so, there was quite a lot of local interest when Ophelia Todd disappeared back in 1973. Ophelia was a genuinely nice woman, and she had done a lot of things in town. She worked to raise money for the Sloan Library, helped to refurbish the war memorial, that sort of thing. But all the summer people liked the idea of raising money. You mention raising money, and their eyes light up and commence to gleam. You mention raising money, and they can get a committee together and appoint a secretary and keep an agenda. They like that. But you mentioned time. Beyond, that is, one big long walloper of a combined cocktail party and committee meeting, and you're out of luck. Time seems to be what summer people mostly set a store by. They lay it by, and if they could put it up in ball jars like preserves, why, they would. Ophelia Todd seemed willing to spend time to do desk duty in the library, as well as to raise money for it. When it got down to using scouring pads and elbow grease on the war memorial, Felia was right out there with town women who had lost sons in 3 different wars, wearing an overall with their hair done up in a kerchief. And when kids needed ferrying to a summer swim program, you'd be as apt to see her as anyone headed down Landing Road with the back of Worth Todd's big shiny pickup full of kids. A good woman. Not a town woman, but a good woman. And when she disappeared, there was concern. Not grieving exactly, because a disappearance is not exactly like a death. It's not like chopping something off with a cleaver, more like something running down the sink so slow you don't know it's all gone until long after it is. 'Twas a Mercedes she drove, Homer said, answering the question I hadn't asked. 2-seater Sportster. Todd got it for her in 64, 65, I guess. You remember her taking the kids to the lake all those years they had frogs and tadpoles? Yeah. She'd drive them no more than 40, mindful they was in the back, but it chafed her. That woman had lead in her foot and the ball-bearing summers in the back of her ankle. It used to be that Homer never talked about his summer people. But then his wife died. 5 years ago it was. She was plowing a grade and the tractor tipped over on her and Homer was taken bad off about it. He grieved for 2 years or so and then seemed to feel better. But he was not the same. He seemed waiting for something to happen, waiting for the next thing. You'd pass his neat little house sometimes at dusk, and he'd be on the porch smoking a pipe with a glass of mineral water on the porch rail, and the sunset would be in his eyes, and pipe smoke around his head, and you'd think, I did, anyway. Homer is waiting for the next thing. This bothered me over a wider range of my mind than I'd like to admit, and at last I decided it was because of it had been me. I wouldn't have been waiting for the next thing. Like a groom who had put on his morning coat and finally has his tie right, is only sitting there on the bed in the upstairs of his house and looking first at himself in the mirror and then at the clock on the mantel and waiting for it to be 11 o'clock so he can get married. If it had been me, I would not have been waiting for the next thing. I would have been waiting for the last thing. But in that waiting period, which ended when Homer went to Vermont a year later, he sometimes talked about those people, to me, to a few others. She never even drove fast with her husband, as far as I know. But when I drove with her, she made that Mercedes strut. A fellow pulled in at the pumps and began to fill up his car. The car had a Massachusetts plate. It wasn't one of those new sports cars that run on unleaded gasoline and hitch every time you step on it. It was one of the old ones, and the speedometer was calibrated all the way up to 160. It was a funny color of brown, and I asked her one time what you call that color, and she said it was champagne. Ain't that good, I says. And she laughs fit to split. I like a woman who will laugh when you don't have to point her right at the joke, you know? The man at the pumps had finished getting his gas. Afternoon, gentlemen, he says as he comes up the steps. A good day to you, I said, and he went inside. Feely was always looking for a shortcut. Homer went on as if we had never been interrupted. That woman was mad for a shortcut. I never saw the beat of it. She said, if you can save enough distance, you'll save time as well. She said her father swore by that scripture. He was a salesman, always on the road, and she went with him when she could, and he was always looking for the shortest way. So she got in that habit. I asked her one time if it wasn't kind of funny. Here she was, on the one hand, spending her time rubbing up that old statue in the square, taking the little ones to the swimming lessons instead of playing tennis and swimming and getting boozed up like normal supper people, and on the other hand, been so damn set on saving 15 minutes between here and Freiburg that thinking about it probably kept her up nights. It just seemed to me the two things went against each other's grain, if you see what I mean. She just looks at me and says, I like being helpful, Homer. I like driving, too, at least sometimes when it's a challenge, but I don't like the time it takes. It's mending clothes. Sometimes you take tucks and sometimes you let things out. Do you see what I mean? I guess so, Mrs., I says, kind of dubious. If sitting behind the wheel of a car was my idea of a really good time all the time, I would look for long cuts, she says, and that tickled me so much I had to laugh. The Massachusetts fellow came out of the store with a six-pack in one hand and some lottery tickets in the other. You enjoy your weekend, Homer says. I always do, the Massachusetts fellow says. I only wish I could afford to live here all year round. Well, we'll keep it all in good order for you when you can come back, Homer says, and the fellow laughs. We watched him drive off towards some place, that Massachusetts plate showing. It was a green one. My Marcy says those are the ones the Massachusetts Motor Registry gives to drivers who ain't had an accident in that strange, angry, fuming state for 2 years. If you have, she says, You got to have a red one so people know how to watch out for you when they see you on the roll. They was in-state people, you know, the both of them, Homer said, as if the Massachusetts fellow had reminded him of the fact. I guess I did know that, I said. The Todds are just about the only birds we got that fly north in the winter. The new one, I don't think she likes flying north too much. He sipped his mineral water and fell silent a moment, thinking. She didn't mind it, though, Homer said. At least, I judge, she didn't, although she used to complain about it something fierce. The complainant was just a way to explain why she was always looking for a shortcut. And you mean her husband didn't mind her traipsing down every wood road and tarnation between here and Bangor, just so she could see if it was 9/10 of a mile shorter? He didn't care piss all, Homer said shortly, and got up and went in the store. There now, Owens, I told myself, you know it ain't safe to ask him questions when he's yarning. And you went right ahead and asked one. And you buggered a story that was starting to shape up promising. I sat there and turned my face up into the sun, and after about 10 minutes, he came out with a boiled egg and sat down. He ate her, and I took care not to say nothing, and the water on Castle Lake sparkled as blue as something as might be told of in a story without treasure. When Homer finished his egg and he had a sip of mineral water, he went on. I was surprised, but still said nothing. It wouldn't have been wise. They had 2 or 3 different chunks of rolling iron, he said. There was a Cadillac and his truck and her little Mercedes Go Devil. Couple of winters, he left a truck in case they wanted to come down and do some skiing. Mostly when the summer was over, he'd drive the caddy back up, and she'd take her Go Devil. I nodded but didn't speak. In truth, I was afraid to risk another comment. Later, I thought it would have taken a lot of comments to shut Homer Buckland up that day. He had been wanting to tell the story of Mrs. Todd's shortcut for a long time. Her little Go Devil had a special odometer in it that told you how many miles was in a trip, and every time she set off from Castle Lake to Bangor, she set it at 0.0 and let her clock up to whatever. She had made a game of it, and she used to chaff me over it. He paused, thinking that over. No, that ain't right. He paused more, and faint lines showed up on his forehead like steps on a library ladder. She made like she made a game of it, but it was a serious business to her. Serious as anything else, anyway. He flapped the hand, and I think he meant the husband. The gov box of the little Go Devil was filled with maps, and there was a few more in the back, where there would be a seat in a regular car. Some was gas station maps, and some was pages that had been pulled from the Rand McNally Road Atlas. She had some maps from Appalachian Trail guidebooks, and a whole mess of topographical survey squares, too. It wasn't her having those maps that made me think it wasn't a game. It was how she drawed lines on all of them, showing routes she'd taken or at least tried to take. She'd been stuck a few times, too, and had to get a pull from some farmer with a tractor and a chain. I was there one day, laying down the bathroom, sitting there with grout squittering out of every damn crack you could see. I dreamed of nothing but squares and cracks that was bleeding grout that night. And she come stood in the doorway and talked to me about it for quite a while. I used to shave her about it, but I was also sort of interested in, not just because my brother Franklin used to live down Bangor, and I'd travel most of the roads she was telling me of. I was interested just because a man like me is always uncommon interested in knowing the shortest way, even if he don't always want to take it. You that way too? Yeah, I said. There's something powerful about knowing the shortest way, even if you take the longer way, because you know your mother-in-law is sitting home. Getting there quick is often for the birds, although no one holding a Massachusetts driver's license seems to know it. But knowing how to get there quick, or even knowing how to get there a way that the person sitting beside you don't know, that has power. Well, she had them roads like a Boy Scout had his knots, Homer said, and smiled his large, sunny grin. She says, wait a minute, like a little girl. And I hear her through the wall rummaging through her desk, and then she comes back with a little notebook that looked like she'd had it a good long time. Cover was all rumpled, don't you know, and some of the pages had pulled loose from those little wire rings on one side. The way most people go is Route 97 to Mechanic Falls, then Route 11 to Lewiston, and then the interstate to Bangor, 156.4 miles. I nodded. If you want to skip the turnpike and save some distance, you'd go to Mechanic Falls Route 11 to Lewiston, Route 202 to Augusta, then up Route 9 through China Lake and Unity and Haven to Bangor. That's 144.9 miles. "You won't save no time that way, Mrs. I says. Not going through Lewiston and Augusta, although I will admit that drive up the old dairy road to Bangor is real pretty. Save enough miles and soon enough you'll save time," she says. And I didn't say that's the way I'd go, although I have a good many times. I'm just running down the routes most people use. "Do you want me to go on?" "No," I says. "Just leave me in this cussed bathroom all by myself staring at all these cussed cracks until I start to rave." "There are four major routes in all," she says. "The one by Route 2 is 163.4 miles. I only tried it once. Too long. That's the one I'd hosey if my wife called me and told me it was leftovers," I says, kind of low. "What was that?" she says. "Nothing," I says, talking to the grout. "Oh, well, the fourth, and there aren't too many who know about it, although they are all good roads, paved anyway, is across Speckled Bird Mountain on 219 to 202 beyond Lewiston. Then if you take Route 19, you can get around Augusta. Then you take the old dairy road. That weighs just 129.2. I didn't say nothing for a little while, and perhaps she thought I was doubting her because she says a little pert, "I know it's hard to believe, but it's so." I said I guess that was about right, and I thought, looking back, it probably was, because that's the way I usually go when I went down to Bangor to see Franklin when he was still alive. I hadn't been that way in years, though. Do you think a man could just, well, forget a road, Dave? I allowed it was possible. The turnpike is easy to think of. After a while, it almost fills a man's mind. And you think, not how could I get from here to there, but how can I get from here to the turnpike ramp that's closest to there? And that made me think that maybe there are lots of roads all over there just going begging. Roads with rock walls beside them. Real roads with blackberry bushes growing alongside them. But nobody to eat the berries but the birds. And gravel pits with old rusted chains hanging down in low curve in front of their entryways. The pits themselves as forgotten as a child's old toys, with scrum grass growing up their deserted, unremembered sides. Roads that have just been forgot except by the people who live on them and think of the quickest way to get off them and onto the turnpike where you can pass on a hill and not fret over it. We like to joke in Maine that you can't get there from here, but maybe the joke is on us. The truth is there's about a damn thousand ways to do it, and man doesn't bother. Homer continued. I grouted Tal all afternoon in that hot little bathroom, and she stood there in the doorway all that time, one foot crossed behind the other, bare-legged, wearing loafers and khaki-colored skirt and a sweater that was some darker. Hair was drawn back in a hostel. She must have been 34 or 35 then, but her face was lit up with what she was telling me, and I swan she looked like a sorority girl home from school on vacation. After a while, she must have got an idea of how long she'd been there cutting the air around her mouth, because she says, "I must be boring the hell out of you, Homer." "Yes, ma'am," I says, "you are. I'd rather you went away and left me to talk to this damn grout." "Don't be smart, Homer," she says. "No, missus, you ain't boring me," I says. "No," she smiles and then goes back to it, paging through her little notebook like a salesman checking his orders. She had those four main ways, well, really three, because she gave up on Route 2 right away. But she must have had 40 different other ways that were playoffs on those. Roads with state numbers, roads without, roads with names, roads without. My hair fair spun with them. And finally she says to me, "You ready for the Blue Ribbon winner, Homer?" "I guess so," I says. "At least it's the Blue Ribbon winner so far," she says. "Do you know, Homer, that a man wrote an article in Science Today in 1921 proving that no man could run a mile in under 4 minutes? He proved it with all sorts of calculations based on the maximum length of the male thigh muscle, maximum length of stride, maximum lung capacity, maximum heart rate, and a whole lot more. I was taken with the article. I was so taken that I gave it to Worth, and asked them to give it to Professor Murray in the math department at the University of Maine. I wanted those figures checked because I was sure they must have been based on the wrong postulates or something. Worth probably thought I was being silly. Ophelia's got to be in her bonnet, is what he says. But he took them. Well, Professor Murray checked through the man's figures quite carefully. And do you know what, Homer?
No, Mrs. Those figures were right. The man's criteria were solid. He proved back in 1923 that a man couldn't run a mile in under 4 minutes. He proved that. But people do it all the time. And do you know that that means?
No, Mrs., I said, although I had a glimmer.
It means that no blue ribbon is forever, she says. Some day, if the world doesn't explode itself in the meantime, someone will run a 2-minute mile in the Olympics. It may take 100 years or 1,000, but it will happen, because there is no ultimate blue ribbon. There is zero, and then there's eternity, and there's mortality, but there is no ultimate. And there she stood, her face clean and scrubbed and shining, that darkish hair of hers pulled back from her brow, as if to say, just you go ahead and disagree if you can. But I couldn't. Because I believe something like that, it is much like what the minister means, I mean, when he talks about grace.
You ready for the blue ribbon winner for now, she says.
Aye, I says, and I even stopped grouting for the time being. I'd reached the tub anyway, and there wasn't nothing left but a lot of those frickin' squirrely little corners. Drawed a deep breath and then spilled it out at me as fast as that auctioneer goes over in Gates Falls when he's been putting the whiskey to himself. And I can't remember it all, but it went something like this.
Homer Buckland shut his eyes for a moment, his big hands lying perfectly still on his long thighs, his face turned up toward the sun. Then he opened his eyes again for a moment. I swan he looked like her. Yes, he did, a 70-year-old man looking like a woman of 34, who was at that moment in her time looking like a college girl of 20. And I can't remember exactly what he said any more than he could remember exactly what she said. Not just because it was complex, but because I was so fetched by how he looked saying it, but it went close enough like this. You set out Route 97 and then cut up Denton Street to the old townhouse road, and that way you get around Castle Rock downtown, but back to 97. 9 miles up, you go on an old logger's road a mile and a half to town road number 6, which takes you to Big Anderson's Road by Site Cedar Mill. There's a cut road, the old-timers called Bear Road, and that gets you to 219. Once you're on the far side of Speckled Bird Mountain, you grab the Townhouse Road, turn left onto the Bullpine Road. There's a swampy patch there, but you can span right through if you get off enough speed on the gravel. And so you come out on Route 106. 106 cuts through Alton's Plantation to the old Dairy Road, and there's 2 or 3 wood roads there that you follow, and so come out on Route 3 just beyond Dairy Hospital. From there, it's only 4 miles to Route 2 in Etna and into Bangor. She paused to get her breath back and looked at me.
Do you know how long that is, all told?
No, ma'am, I says, think it sounds like about 190 miles and 4 bust springs.
It's 116.4 miles, she says.
I laughed. The laugh was out of me before. I thought I wasn't doing myself any favor if I wanted to hear this story to the end. But Homer grinned himself and nodded.
I know, and you know. I don't like to argue with anyone, Dave. But there's a difference between having your leg pulled and getting it shook like a damn apple tree.
You don't believe me, she says?
Well, it's hard to believe, Mrs., I said.
Leave that grout to dry and I'll show you, she says. You can finish behind the tub tomorrow. Come on, Homer. I'll leave a note for Worth. He may not be back tonight anyway. And you can call your wife. We'll be sitting down to dinner in the pilot's grill, and she looks at her watch. 2 hours and 45 minutes from right now. And if it's a minute longer, I'll buy you a bottle of Irish mist to take home with you. You see, my dad was right. Enough miles saved, and you'll save time, even if you have to go through every damn bog and sump in Kennebec County to do it. Now, what do you say?
She was looking at me with those brown eyes just like lamps. There was a devilish look in them that said, turn your cap round backwards, Homer, and climb aboard this hoss. I be first and you be second, let the devil take the hindmost. And there was a grin on her face that said the exact same thing. And I tell you, Dave, I wanted to go.
I didn't even want to top that damn can of grout. And I certain sure don't want to drive that goat devil of hers. I want to just sit in on the shotgun side and watch her get in, see her skirt come up a little, see her pull it down over her knees or not, watch her hair shine. He trailed off suddenly, let off a sarcastic, choked laugh. That laugh of his sounded like a shotgun loaded with rock salt. Just call up Megan and says, "You know, Felia Todd, that woman you're halfway to being so jealous of now, you can't see straight and can't ever find a good word to say about her? Well, her and me is going to make this speed run down to Bangor in that little champagne-colored she-devil Mercedes of hers, so don't wait dinner. Just call her up and say that. Oh, yes, oh, yeah." And he laughed again with his hands lying there on his legs, just as natural as ever was, and I seen something in his face that was almost hateful. And after a minute, he took his glass of mineral water from the railing there and got outside some of it. "You didn't go," I said. "Not then." He laughed, and his laugh was gentler. She must have seen something in my face, because it was like she found herself again. She stopped looking like a sorority girl and just looked like Felia Todd again. She looked down at the notebook like she didn't know what it was that she had been holding and put it down by her side, almost behind her skirt. I says, "I'd like to do just that, missus, but I got to finish up here, and my wife has got a roast on for dinner." She says, "I understand, Homer. I just got a little carried away. I do that a lot, all the time," Worth says. Then she kind of straightened up and says, "But the offer holds. Any time you want to go, you can even throw your shoulder to the back, and if we get stuck somewhere, might save me $5. And she laughed. "I'll take you up on it, Mrs. I says. And she seen that I meant what I said and wasn't just being polite. "And before you just go on believing that 116 miles to Bangor is out of the question, get out your own map and see how many miles it would be as the crow flies." I finished the towels and went home and ate leftovers. There was no roast, and I think Felia Todd knew it. And after Megan was in bed, I got out my yardstick and a pen and my mobile map of the state, and I did what she had told me, because it had laid hold of my mind a bit. You see, I drew a straight line and did out the calculations according to the scale of miles. I was some surprised, because if you went from Castle Rock up there to Bangor, like one of those little Piper Cubs could fly on a clear day, if you didn't have to mind lakes or stretches of lumber company woods that was chained off, or bogs, or crossing rivers where there was no bridges, why, it would just be 79 miles, give or take. I jumped a little. "Measure it yourself if you don't believe me," Homer said. "I never knew Maine was so small until I seen that." He had himself a drink and then looked around at me. There come a time the next spring when Megan was away in New Hampshire visiting her brother. I had to go down to the Todd's house to take off the storm doors and put on the screens, and the little Mercedes goat devil was there. She was down by herself. She come to the door and says, "Homer, have you come to put on the screen doors?" And right off I says, "No, missus, I come to see if you want to give me a ride down to Bangor the short way." Well, she looked at me with no expression on her face at all, and I thought she had forgotten all about it. I felt my face getting red the way it will when you feel you just pulled one hell of a boner. Then, just when I was getting ready to apologize, her face bust into that grin again. She says, "You just stand right there while I get my keys, and don't change your mind, Homer." She come back a minute later with an M in her hand. "If we get stuck, you'll see mosquitoes just about the size of dragonflies." "I've seen one as big as English sparrows up in Rangeley, missus," I said, "and I guess we're both a spot too heavy to be carried off." She laughs. "Well, I warned you anyway. Come on, Homer." "And if we ain't there in 2 hours and 45 minutes, I says, kind of sly, "you was going to buy me a bottle of Irish mist." She looked at me kind of surprised. The driver's door of the go-devil opened and 1 foot inside. "Hell, Homer," she says, "I told you that was the blue ribbon for then. I found a way up there that's shorter. We'll be there in 2.5 hours. Get in, Homer. We're going to roll." He paused again, hands lying calm on his thighs, his eyes dulling, perhaps seeing the champagne-colored two-seater heading up the Todd's steep driveway. She stood the car still at the end of it and says, "You sure?" "Let her rip," I says.
The ball bearing in her ankle rolled, and that heavy foot come down. I can't tell you nothing much about what all happened after that, except after a while I could hardly take my eyes off her. There was something wild that crept into her face, Dave. Something wild and something free, and it frightened my heart. She was beautiful, and I was took with love for her. Anyone would have been. Any man, anyway, and maybe any woman, too, but I was scared of her, too, because she looked like she could kill you for I left the road and fell on you, and she decided to love you back. She was wearing blue jeans and an old white shirt with the sleeves rolled up. I had an idea she was maybe fixing to paint something on the back deck when I came by. But after we had been going for a while, seemed like she was dressed in nothing but all this white billowy stuff, like a picture in one of those old gods and goddesses books, he thought, looking out across the lake, his face very somber. Like the huntress that was supposed to drive the moon across the sky. Diana? Aye. Moon was her go-devil. Phidia looked like that to me, and I just tell you, fear out, that I was stricken in love for her, and never would have made a move, even though I was some younger than I am now. I would not have made a move, even if I had been 20, although I suppose I might have at 16, and been killed for it. Killed if she looked at me, was the way it felt. She was like that woman driving the moon across the sky, halfway up over the splashboard with gossamer stoles all flying out behind her in silver cobwebs, and her hair streaming back to show the dark little hollows of her temples, lashing those horses and telling me to get along faster and never mind how they blowed. Just faster, faster, faster. We went down a lot of wood roads, the first two or three I knew, and after that I didn't know none of them. We must have been a sight to those trees that had never seen nothing with a motor in it before but big old pulp trucks and snowmobiles. That little goat devil that most likely have looked more at home on the Sunset Boulevard than shooting through those woods, spitting and bullying its way up the one hill and then slamming down the next through those dusty green bars of afternoon sunlight. She had the top down, and I could smell everything in those woods. And you know what an old fine smell that is, like something which has been mostly left alone and is not much troubled. We went on across corduroy, which had been laid over some of the boggiest parts, and black sand squelched up between some of those curt logs, and she laughed like a kid. Some of the logs was old and rotted, because there hadn't been nobody down a couple of those roads, except for her, that is, and I'm going to say 5 or 10 years. We was alone, except for the birds and whatever animals seen us. The sound of that go-devil's engine, first buzzing along and then winding up high and fierce when she punched in the clutch and shifted down. That was the only motor sound I could hear. And although I knew we had to be close to some place all the time, I mean, these days you always are, I started to feel like we had gone back in time, and there was nothing. That if we stopped and I climbed a high tree, I wouldn't see nothing in any direction but woods and woods and more woods. And all the time she's just hammering that thing along, her hair all out behind her, smiling, her eyes flashing. So we come out on Speckled Bird Mountain Road, and for a while I known where we were again, and then she turned off, and for just a bit I thought I knew, and then I didn't even bother to kid myself no more. We went cut slam down another woods road, and then we come out, I swear it, on a nice paved road with a sign that said Motorway B. You ever heard of a road in the state of Maine that was called Motorway B? No, I said, sounds English. I looked English. These trees like willows overhung the road. Now watch out here, Homer, she says. One of those nearly grabbed me a month ago and gave me an Indian burn. I didn't know what she was talking about and started to say so, and then I seen that even though there was no wind, the branches of those trees was dipping down. They was wavering down. They looked black and wet inside the fuzz of green on them. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Then one of them snatched off my cap, and I knew I wasn't sleeping. Hey, I shouts back, give that back. Too late now, Homer, she says and laughs. There's daylight just up ahead. We're okay. Then another one of them comes down, on her side this time, and snatches at her. I swear it did. She ducked, and it caught in her hair and pulled the lock of it out. Ouch, damn it, that hurts, she yells. But she was laughing, too. The car swerved a little when she ducked, and I got a look into the woods. And holy God, Dave, everything in there was moving. There was grass waving and plants that was all knotted together, so it seemed like they made faces. And I seen something sitting in a squat on top of a stump. And it looked like a tree toad, only it was as big as a full-grown cat. Then we come out of the shade to the top of a hill, and she says, "There, that was exciting, wasn't it?" As if she was talking about no more than a walk through the haunted house at the Freiburg Fair. 5 minutes later, we swung onto another of her wood roads. I didn't want no more woods right then, I can tell you that for sure. But these were just plain old woods. 1/2 hour after that, we was pulling into the parking lot of the Pilot's Grill and Banger. She points to that little odometer for trips and says, "Take a gander, Homer. I did it. And it says 111.6. What do you think now? Do you believe in my shortcut?" That wild look had mostly faded out of her, and she was just feeling tired again. But that other look wasn't entirely gone. It was like she was two women, Philia and Diana. And the part of her that was Diana was so much in control when she was driving the back roads that the part that was Philia didn't have no idea that her shortcut was taking her through places that ain't on any map of Maine, not even on those survey squares. She says again, "What do you think of my shortcut, Homer?" And I says the first thing to come to my mind, which ain't something you usually say to a lady like Philia Todd. "It's a real pill cutter, missus," I says. She laughs, just as pleased as Punch. And I seen it then, just as clear as glass. She didn't remember none of the funny stuff, not the willow branches, except they weren't willows, not at all, not anything like 'em or anything else that grabbed off my hat, not that motorway B sign or that awful-looking toad thing. She didn't remember none of that funny stuff. Either I had dreamt it or she had dreamt it wasn't. All I knew for sure, Dave, was that we had rolled only 111 miles and gotten to Bangor. And that wasn't no daydream. It was right there on that little go-devil odometer in black and white. "Well, it is," she says. "It is a piss cutter. I only wish I could get Worth to give it a go sometime, but he'll never get out of his rut unless somebody blasts him out of it. And it probably take a Titan II missile to do that, because I believe he has built himself a fallout shelter at the bottom of that rut. Come on in, Homer, and let's dump some dinner into you." And she bought me one hell of a dinner, Dave. But I couldn't eat very much of it. I kept thinking about what the ride back might be like, now that it was drawing down dark. Then, about halfway through the meal, she excused herself and made a telephone call. When she come back, she asked me if I would mind driving the Go Devil back to Castle Rock for her. She said she had talked to some woman what's on the same school committee as her, and the woman said they had some kind of problem about something or other. She said she'd grab herself a Hertz car if Worth couldn't see her back down. "Do you mind awfully driving back in the dark?" she asked me. She looked at me, kind of smiling, and I knew she remembered some of it all right. Christ knows how much, but she remembered enough to know I wouldn't want to try her way after dark, if ever at all, although I seen by the light in her eyes that it wouldn't have bothered her a bit. So I said it wouldn't bother me, and I finished my meal better than when I started it. It was drawing down dark by the time we was done, and she run us over to the house of the woman she'd called. And when she gets out, she looks at me with that same light in her eyes and says, "Now, you sure you don't want to wait, Homer? I saw a couple of side roads just today, and although I can't find them on my maps, I think they might chop a few miles." I says, "Well, missus, I would, but at my age, the best bed to sleep in is my own. I've found I'll take your car back and never put a ding in her, although I guess I'll probably put on some more miles than you did." And she laughed, kind of soft, and she gave me a kiss. That was the best kiss I ever had in my whole life, Dave. It was just on the cheek, and it was the chaste kiss of a married woman, but it was as ripe as a peach, or like those flowers that open in the dark, and when her lips touch my skin, I felt like, I don't know exactly what I felt like, because a man can't easily hold on to those things that happened to him with a girl who was ripe when the world was young, or how those things felt. I'm talking around what I mean, but I think you understand. Those things all get a red cast of them in your memory, and you cannot see through it at all. You're a sweet man, Homer, and I love you for listening to me and riding with me, she says. Drive safe. Then in she went to that woman's house. Me, I drove home. How did you go? I asked. He laughed softly. By the turnpike, you damn fool, he said. And I'd never seen so many wrinkles in his face before as I did then. He sat there looking into the sky. Came the summer she disappeared. I didn't see much of her. That was the summer. We had the fire, you'll remember. And then the big storm that knocked down all the trees. A busy time for caretakers. Oh, I thought about her from time to time. And about that day and about that kiss. And it started to seem like a dream to me. Like one time when I was out plowing George Bascom's Westfield. The one that looks across the lake at the mountains. Dreaming about what teenage boys dream of. And I pulled up this rock with the narrow blades and it split open. And it bled. At least, it looked to me like it bled. Red stuff come running out of the cleft in the rock and soaked into the soil. And I never told no one but my mother. And I never told her what it meant to me or what happened to me, although she washed my drawers. And maybe she knew. Anyway, she suggested I ought to pray on it, which I did, but I never got no enlightenment. And after a while, something started to suggest to my mind that it had been a dream. It's that way sometimes. There's holes in the middle, Dave. Do you know that? Yes, I says, thinking of one night when I'd seen something. That was in 59, a bad year for us. But my kids didn't know it was a bad year. All they knew was that they wanted to eat just like they always. I'd seen a bunch of whitetail in Henry Brueger's backfield. And I was out there after dark with a jacklight in August. You can shoot, too, when there's summer fat. The second will come back and sniff at the first, as if to say, what the hell? Is it fall already? And you can pop him like a bowling pin. You can hack off enough meat to feed yowans for 6 weeks and bury what's left. Those are two whitetails the hunters who come in November don't get a shot at. But kids have to eat. Like the man from Massachusetts says, he'd like to be able to afford to live here the year round. And all I can say is sometimes you pay for the privilege after dark. So there I was, and I seen this big orange light in the sky. It comes down and down, and I stood and watched it with my mouth hung on down to my breastbone. And when it hit the lake, the whole of it was lit up for a minute, a purple-orange that seemed to go right up to the sky and rays. Wasn't nobody ever said nothing to me about that light, and I never said nothing to nobody myself, partly because I was afraid they'd laugh, but also because they'd wonder what the hell I'd been doing out there after dark to start with. And after a while, it was like Homer said, it seemed like a dream I had once had, and it didn't signify to me because I couldn't make nothing of it, which would turn under my hand. It was like a moonbeam. It didn't have no handle, and it didn't have no blade. I couldn't make it work, so I left it alone, like a man does when he knows the day is going to come up nevertheless. There are holes in the middle of things, Homer said, and he sat up straighter like he was mad, right in the damn middle of things, not even to the left or right, where peripheral vision is, and you could say, well, but hell. They are there, and you go around them like you'd go around a pothole in the road that could break an axle, you know? And you forget it. Or like if you're plowing, you can plow a dip. But if there's something like a break in the earth where you see darkness, like a cave might be there, you say, go around, old hoss. Leave that alone. I got a good shot over here to the leftards, because it wasn't a cave he was looking for. Or some kind of college excitement, but good plowing. Holes in the middle of things. He fell still a long time, and I let him be still, didn't have no urge to move him. And at last he says, she disappeared in August. I seen her for the first time in early July, and she looked. Homer turned to me and spoke each word with careful, spaced emphasis. Dave Owens, she looked gorgeous, gorgeous and wild and almost untamed. The little wrinkles I started to notice around her eyes all seemed to be gone. Worth Todd, he was at some conference or something in Boston, and she stands there at the edge of the deck. I was out in the middle with my shirt off, and she says, Homer, you'll never believe it. No, missus, but I'll try, I says. I found two new roads, she says, and I got to Bangor this last time, and just 67 miles. I remembered what she said before, and I says, that's not possible, missus. Begging your pardon, but I did the mileage on the map myself, and 79 is tops, as the crow flies. She laughed, and she looked prettier than ever, like a goddess in the sun, on one of those hills in a story where there's nothing but green grass and fountains and no puckies to tear at a man's forearms at all. That's right, she says, and you can't run a mile in under 4 minutes. It's been mathematically proved. It ain't the same, I says. It's the same, she says. Fold the map and see how many miles it is then, Homer. It can be a little less than a straight line if you fold it a little, or it can be a lot less if you fold it a lot. I remembered our ride then, the way you remember dreaming. I said, Mrs., you can fold the map on paper, but you can't fold land. Or at least you shouldn't ought to try. You want to leave it alone. No, sir, she says. It's the one thing right now in my life that I won't leave alone, because it's there, and it's mine. 3 weeks later, that would be about 2 weeks before she disappeared, she gave me a call from Bangor. She says, Worth has gone to New York, and I'm coming down. I've misplaced my damn key, Homer. I'd like you to open the house so I can get in. Well, that call come at 8 o'clock, just when it was starting to come down dark. I had a sandwich and a beer before leaving, about 20 minutes, and then I took a ride down there. All in all, I'd say I was 45 minutes. When I got there to the Todd's, I seen there was a light on in the pantry. I didn't leave on while I was coming down the driveway. I was looking at that, and I almost run right into her little goat devil. It was parked kind of on a slant, the way a drunk would park it, and it was splashed with muck all the way up to the windows, and there was this stuff stuck in that mud along the body that looks like seaweed. Only, when my lights hit it, it seemed to be moving. I parked behind and got out of my truck. That stuff wasn't seaweed, but it was weeds, and it was moving, kind of slow and sluggish, like it was dying. I touched a piece of it and tried to wrap itself around my hand. It felt nasty and awful. I drugged my hand away and wiped it on my pants. I went around to the front of the car. It looked like it had come through at about 90 miles of splash and low country. It looked tired, it did. Bugs were splashed all over the windshield, only they didn't look like no kind of bugs I ever seen before. There was a moth that was about the size of a sparrow, its wings still flapping a little feeble and dying. There were things like mosquitoes, only they had real eyes that you could see, and they seemed to be seeing me. I could hear those weeds scraping against the body of the goat devil, dying, trying to get a hold on something. And all I could think of was, where in the hell had she been? And how did she get here in only 3/4 of an hour? Then I seen something else. There was some kind of an animal half smashed onto the radiator grill, just under where the Mercedes ornament is, the one that looks kind of like a star looped up into a circle. Now, most small animals you kill on the road is bore right under the car, because they are crouching when it hits them, hoping it'll just go over and leave them with their hide still attached to their meat. But every now and then, one will jump, not away, but right at the damn car, as if to get in one good bite of whatever the buggerly thing is that's going to kill it. I've known that to happen. This thing had maybe done that, and it looked mean enough to jump a Sherman tank. It looked like something which come of a mating between a woodchuck and weasel, but there was other stuff thrown in that body didn't even want to look at. It hurt your eyes, Dave. Worse than that, it hurt your mind. Its pelt was matted with blood, and there was claws sprung out of the pads on its feet like a cat's claws, only longer. It had big yellowy eyes, only they was glazed. When I was a kid, I had a porcelain marble, a croaker, that looked like that, and teeth, long, thin needle teeth, that looked almost like darning needles sticking out of its mouth. Some of them was sunk right into that still grill work. That's why it was still hanging on it. It had hung its own self on by the teeth. I looked at it and knowed it had a head full of poison, just like a rattlesnake. And it jumped at that goat devil when it saw what it was about to be run down, trying to bite it to death. And I wouldn't be the one to try and yunk it off there, because I had cuts in my hands, hay cuts, and I thought it would kill me as dead as a stone parker as some of that poison seeped into the cuts. I went around to the driver's door and opened it. The inside light come on, and I looked at the special odometer that she sets for trips. What I seen there was 31.6. I looked at that for a bit, and then I went to the back door. She'd forced the screen and broke the glass by the lock, so she could get her hand through and let herself in. There was a note that said, Dear Homer, got here a little sooner than I thought I would. Found a shortcut, and it's a dilly. You hadn't come yet, so I let myself in like a burglar. Worth is coming day after tomorrow. Can you get the screen fixed and the door reglazed by then? Hope so. Things like that always bother him. If I don't come out to say hello, you'll know I'm asleep. The drive was very tiring, but I was here in no time. Ophelia. Tiring? I took another look at that bogey thing hanging off the grill of her car, and I thought, yes, sir, it must have been tiring. By God, yes. He paused again and cracked a restless knuckle. I seen her only once more, about a week later. Worth was there, but he was swimming out in the lake back and forth, like he was sawing wood or signing papers. More like he was signing papers, I guess.
"Missus," I says, "this ain't my business, but you ought to leave well enough alone. That night you come back and broke the glass of the door to come in, I seen something hanging off the front of your car."
"Oh, the chuck. I took care of that," she says. "Christ," I says, "I hope you took some care."
"I wore Worth's gardening gloves," she said. "It wasn't anything anyway, Homer, but a jumped up woodchuck with a little poison in it."
"But, missus," I says, "where there's woodchucks, there's bears. And if that's what the woodchucks looks like along your shortcut, what's going to happen to you if a bear shows up?"
She looks at me, and I seen that other woman in her, that Diana woman. She says, "If things are different along those roads, Homer, maybe I am different, too. Look at this." Her hair was done up in a clip at the back, looked like some sort of butterfly and had a stick through it. She let it down. It was a kind of hair that would make a man wonder what it would look like spread out over a pillow. She says, "It was coming in gray, Homer. Do you see any gray?" And she spread it with her fingers so the sun could shine on it.
"No, ma'am," I says. She looks at me, her eyes all a-sparkle, and she says, "Your wife is a good woman, Homer Buckland, but she has seen me in the store and in the post office, and we've passed the odd word or two. And I've seen her looking at my hair in a kind of satisfied way that only women know. I know what she says, and what she tells her friends, that Ophelia Todd has started dyeing her hair, but I have not. I have lost my way looking for a shortcut more than once. Lost my way, and lost my gray." And she laughed, not like a college girl, but like a girl in high school. I admired her and longed for her beauty, but I seen that other beauty in her face as well just then, and I felt afraid again, afraid for her and afraid of her. "Missus," I says, "you stand to lose more than a little stack in your hair."
"No," she says, "I tell you, I'm different over there. I am all myself over there. When I'm going along that road in my little car, I am not Ophelia Todd, Worth Todd's wife, who could never carry a child to term, or that woman who tried to write poetry and failed at it, or the woman who sits and takes notes in committee meetings, or anything or anyone else. When I'm on that road, I'm in the heart of myself, and I feel like..."
"Diana," I said.
She looked at me kind of funny and kind of surprised, and then she laughed. "Oh, like some goddess, I suppose," she said. "She'll do better than most because I'm a night person. I love to stay up until my book is done or until the national anthem comes on the TV, and because I am very pale like the moon. Worth is always saying I need a tonic or blood test or some sort of similar bosh. But in her heart, what every woman wants to be is some kind of goddess, I think. Men pick up a ruined echo of that thought and try to put them on pedestals. A woman who will pee down her own leg if she does not squat. It's funny when you stop to think of it. But what a man senses is not what a woman wants. A woman wants to be in the clear, is all. To stand, if she will, or walk." Her eyes turned towards a little go-devil in the driveway and narrowed. Then she smiled. "Or to drive, Homer. A man will not see that. He thinks a goddess wants to loll on a slope, somewhere on the foothills of Olympus, and eat fruit. But there is no god or goddess in that. All a woman wants is what a man wants. A woman wants to drive."
"Be careful where you drive, missus," is all I says, and she laughs and gives me a kiss spang in the middle of the forehead. She says, "I will, Homer, but it didn't mean nothing, and I known it, because she said it like a man who says he'll be careful to his wife or his girl when he knows he won't, can't. I went back to my truck and waved to her once, and it was a week later that Worth reported her missing. Her and that go-devil both. Todd waited 7 years and had her declared legally dead. And then he waited another year for good measure. I'll give that sucker that much. And then he married the second Miss Todd, the one that just went by. And I don't expect you'll believe a single damn word of the whole yarn." In the sky, one of those big flat-bottom clouds moved enough to disclose the ghost of the moon, half full and pale as milk, and something in my heart leaped up at the sight, half in fright, half in love. "I do, though," I said, "every friggin' damn word. And even if it ain't true, Homer, it ought to be." He gave me a hug around the neck with his forearm, which is all men can do since the world don't let them kiss but only women, and laughed and got up. "Even if it shouldn't ought to be, it is," he said.
He got his watch out of his pants and looked at it. "I got to go down the road and check on the Scott place. You want to come?"
"I believe I'll sit here for a while," I said, "and think."
He went to the steps and turned back and looked at me, half smiling.
"I believe she was right," he said. "She was different along those roads she found. Wasn't nothing that would dare touch her. You or me, maybe, but not her. And I believe she's young."
Then he got in his truck and set off to check the Scott place.
That was 2 years ago, and Homer has since gone to Vermont, as I think I told you. One night he come over to see me. His hair was combed and he had a shave and he smelled of some nice lotion. His face was clear and his eyes were alive. That night he looked 60 instead of 70, and I was glad for him, and I envied him, and I hated him a little too. Arthritis is one buggardly great old fisherman, and that night Homer didn't look like arthritis had any fish hooks sunk into his hands the way they were sunk into mine.
"I'm going," he said.
"Aye, aye.
All right. Did you see the 40 in your mail?"
"Don't want none 40," he said. "My bills are paid. I'm going to make a clean break."
"Well, give me your address. I'll drop you a line from one time to the old one, old Haas."
Already I could feel loneliness settling over me like a cloak, and looking at him, I knew that things were not quite what they seemed.
"Don't have none yet," he said.
"All right," I said. "Is it Vermont, Homer?"
"Well," he said, "it'll do for people who want to know."
I almost didn't say it, and then I did. "What does she look like now?"
"Like Diana," he said, "but she is kinder."
"I envy you, Homer," I said, and I did. I stood at the door. It was twilight in that deep part of summer when the fields fill with perfume and Queen Anne's lace. A full moon was beating a silver track across the lake. He went across my porch and down the steps. A car was standing on the soft shoulder of the road, its engine idling heavy, the way the old ones do that still run full bore straight ahead and damn the torpedoes. Now that I think of it, the car looked like a torpedo. It looked beat up some, but as if it could go the ton without breathing hard. He stopped at the foot of my steps and picked something up. It was his gas can, the big one that holds 10 gallons. He went down my walk to the passenger side of the car. She leaned over and opened the door. The inside light came on, and just for a moment I saw her. Long red hair around her face, her forehead shining like a lamp, shining like the moon. He got in and she drove away. I stood out on my porch and watched the taillights of her little go-devil twinkling red in the dark, getting smaller and smaller. They were like embers. Then they were like flicker flies, and then they were gone. Vermont, I tell the folks from town, and Vermont they believe, because it's as far as most of them can see inside their heads. Sometimes I almost believe it myself, mostly when I'm tired and done up. Other times I think about them, though. All this October, I've done it so, it seems, because October is the time when men think mostly about far places and the roads which might get them there. I sit on the bench in front of Bell's Mark and think about Homer Buckland and about the beautiful girl who leaned over to open his door when he comes down that path with a full red gasoline can in his right hand. She looked like a girl of no more than 16, a girl on her learner's permit, and her beauty was terrible. But I believe it would no longer kill the man it turned itself on. For a moment her eyes lit on me. I was not killed, although part of me died at her feet. Olympus must be a glory to the eyes and the heart, and there are those who crave it, and those who find a clear way to it, mayhap. But I know Castle Rock like the back of my hand, and I could never leave it for no shortcuts where the roads may go. In October the sky over the lake is no glory, but it is passing fair, with those big white clouds that move so slow. I sit here on the bench and think about Phileas Todd and Homer Buckland, and I don't necessarily wish I was where they are, but I still wish I was a smoking man.